You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish people.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Welcome to Speak Up for Tuesday, July 21st. My name is Magnus, and I'm your host for today's program. We have some interesting things coming up in a moment. The world update about what's happening in with coronavirus around the world, courtesy of the BBC World Service. After that, we're going to talk a little about some of the developments happening here in BC. Dr. Bonnie Henry gave an update yesterday that was rather concerning with a big rise in cases. We have some good music for you. We're going to talk a bit about, I brought this up a little bit yesterday, but talk about the idea of endonyms and exonyms, which is the names that get attached to people and places as created within the cultures of those places or peoples, and from outside the cultures of those people or places. An interesting concept, which is both mundane, but also in some cases problematic, but not in every case. It's an interesting idea, and we'll talk a bit about that. We have Front Burner coming up in the latter part of the program. They're going to talk about the return of Major League Baseball. A very interesting problem with all the different major sports leagues and major sports doing what they can to get back into operations. So we'll talk a bit about, they'll be talking a bit about that in Front Burner in the end of the program. First off, though, here's the World Coronavirus Update.
This is the Coronavirus Global Update on Monday, the 20th of July. I'm Alex Ritson. Promising results for a vaccine and a treatment developed in the UK. EU leaders still haven't agreed a multi-billion euro recovery fund. And sumo wrestling in front of live studio audiences resumes in Japan. Trials of a coronavirus vaccine developed by the University of Oxford have shown it's safe, causes few side effects, and induces a strong immune response in volunteers. Further research is still needed, but our medical correspondent Fergus Walsh believes the results are promising.
We've got news that shows it produces a strong immune response in both antibodies and T-cell responses, which are both important for controlling infection. It doesn't mean to say it's going to work in the real world, but it is promising.
Meanwhile, initial results from another British clinical trial suggest a new treatment could significantly reduce deaths from COVID-19. The tests by biotech firm Synergen involved patients inhaling a protein called interferon beta, which helps the body fight viruses. When given to hospital patients, it cut the odds of them developing severe disease by almost 80%. EU leaders are meeting for a fourth day to try to agree a 750 billion euro coronavirus recovery package. Before heading back to negotiations in Brussels on Monday morning, the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said she was hopeful they could reach a compromise.
We're entering now in the crucial phase, but I have the impression that European leaders really want an agreement. I'm positive for today. We're not there yet, but things are moving in the right direction.
Key sticking point is that five countries want to limit the size of the fund and ensure it consists mostly of repayable loans, not grants. Australia is battling a fresh outbreak of the virus with a second day of record cases registered in Melbourne. Officials have launched an inquiry into how infected travellers returned to the country from overseas could have spread the disease, despite the government's quarantine programme, which forced people to self-isolate in hotels for 14 days. Professor Catherine Bennett is an epidemiologist.
There's questions about maintenance of the rules that people understood were in place, the training and guidance given to security guards and others involved in supporting the quarantine program, and that's what this inquiry is looking into.
New regulations have come into force in France, which has also seen a resurgence of infections. People must now wear face masks in all indoor spaces, such as shops, restaurants and banks, or risk a fine of $150. More than 140,000 people have now died from coronavirus in the US, almost a quarter of the total deaths worldwide. According to Johns Hopkins University, the US has the seventh highest mortality rate. But in an interview with Fox News, President Trump insisted it had one of the lowest.
I think we have one of the lowest mortality rates in the world.
We're going to take a look. We had 900 deaths on a single day.
We will take a look.
This week.
Ready? You have the numbers, please? Because I heard we had the best mortality rate.
Multiple countries have launched track and trace systems to help reduce the spread of COVID-19, but privacy campaigners say the system in England has broken data protection laws. The British government admitted it didn't assess the programme's impact on privacy. Jim Killock is the director of the Open Rights Group, which campaigns against snooping by officials. He believes the oversight could worsen the crisis.
Rather like doing a fire assessment before you open a building, they haven't done the basic checks to make sure that data is handled safely. So if we have a situation where the software is unsafe, then public trust is undermined. If the public trust is undermined, people don't participate in the system, then you have a greater public health problem.
Cinemas in China are reopening after 6 months. Officials have allowed screens in low-risk areas to reopen, but tickets must be sold online, groups should sit at least a metre apart, and no food or drinks can be served. For the first time since January, sumo wrestling has been held in front of a live audience in Japan. The tournament began in Tokyo on Sunday, despite a rising number of coronavirus infections there in recent days. Spectators have to get their temperature checked, wear face masks, and refrain from cheering. But these fans said it was worth it.
Well, it's scary, isn't it? But I love sumo. You enjoy it live by being a part of the spectacle yourself.
I am grateful that they are doing this. This is Japan's national sport. You want to watch this live.
This is the Coronavirus Global Update.
And thank you to the BBC for that. Let's take a look at the weather here in the Vancouver region. Currently 20 degrees here in Burnaby. Same in Vancouver. And the forecast today going to get up to about 25 degrees, sunny with a bit of cloudy periods, down to 17 overnight. Not too bad, but a little warm for my taste. Tomorrow, sunny with cloudy periods, highs up to 21, lows down to 17. Thursday and Friday get a little more cloudy and rain called for each day. But the weekend is looking pretty good with both Saturday and Sunday calling for sunny skies, highs to 22 and 24 on each day. And similar outlook for Vancouver, just a little cooler as it's closer to the coast. So not a bad week coming up. We're going to get a couple days of rain and then some back to the sun for the weekend when we need that nice weather most. And, you know, the rain isn't so bad because so far we've had a pretty mild fire season here in BC. You know, the upside of cool and somewhat wet weather is fewer forest fires throughout the province. So a little more rain and, you know, coming in to keep things calm on that front isn't a terrible thing. And if we get some sun on the weekend, that's awesome too. Next up, we are going to play something. I played this band on yesterday's show. I'm going to play them again today. Indigenous band from Edmonton called Nihiwayak. No, hold it. Nehiyawak. This is the lead-off track from their album. And I'm going to... It's in Cree, which means I'm going to do my best to pronounce this, but I bet it, even if I get all the syllables, it's still going to be all wrong. But it is the lead off track. I think it's the lead off track. Let me look again. Anyway, it's Kisikakawanisipipayak. So hopefully, I bet if you're a Cree speaker out there, I bet that meant nothing to you because I mangled it. Anyway, so I apologize for that. Great band, though. Nihiyawak from their album Nipsey. Nahiyawak, First Nations Indigenous band from Edmonton. I won't try and say the name of that track again. But very interesting band. Got a lot of airplay on campus stations across Canada with its release, which is great. The name of the band, Nahiyawak, is a Cree term for the Cree people. Often, sometimes that kind of term is referred to as an endonym, the opposite being an exonym, which is a name or a term that originates outside of the cultural area and geographic area for peoples and geographic features in the area. It's quite an interesting article, which I'd encourage you to check out on Wikipedia, that goes into a lot of detail about this sort of this phenomenon, which is in fact super common across the world, because as cultures and language differ from area to area, often, you know, adjacent or neighboring cultures will have their own names in their own language for terms in and for groups in the other in a neighboring geographical and cultural area. One of the most classic examples is Germany, which is known as Deutschland to the Germans in Germany, but known by many other names, which are not even closely related to that term, in neighboring countries. You know, so it's Alemannia in France, and Germany in English speaking countries, Tyskland in the Scandinavian countries, so on and so on. The idea of exonyms and endonyms is very relevant to today, though, because many cultures, particularly ones that have found themselves in a marginalized position, particularly relative to a dominant culture, have often had names and terms imposed on them as part of that unbalanced relationship. And this is often causes has been a source of friction and, you know, unhappiness. One of the things with exonyms that is often very problematic is particularly when they're adopted, a term is adopted by a dominant culture, is often the terms that come up, particularly towards peoples, are very much built around an idea of us and them. Even when you have just adjacent cultures which are not in an unbalanced power dynamic, often the us culture will have a name for themselves which will refer to them as the original peoples or the first peoples or the something along those lines. And then they will refer to their neighbors as something akin to foreigners or barbarians or some other kind of othering term. And then you get a third party coming along, and they start picking up these kinds of names and start using it to refer to the different people. So now, a cultural group which has their own name for themselves, which represents their own feelings about themselves, are now broadly referred to by many groups, and particularly often a dominant group, by an othering term that is in some ways derogatory. And even if this process originates just through adopting terms into different situations without necessarily understanding the dynamic that works within those terms, it still, of course, becomes problematic. And we see that in, a case that's very relevant to today is the idea of the term Eskimo, which was used for many years within the English language to refer to the Inuit peoples of the North, but really doesn't have any relationship to terms they use for themselves. And, of course, part of the problem is even if a term isn't necessarily derogatory, it is not a term that people want or desire to refer to themselves, and that becomes something we need to respect. But the whole idea of endonyms and exonyms is complicated because it's not always sort of stuck in that odd power dynamic or that odd situation of imbalance between dominant groups and marginalized groups. Europe has a lot of fascinating examples, with Germany being one. But there's one here which is both interesting, but also I think in some ways kind of provides a bit of an explanation of how sometimes you can get sort of problematic terms. I don't think this one particularly itself represents a problem for the groups involved, but you can see how it would, in many situations, it would become problematic. And this is particularly relates to Slavic terms for Germans or German-speaking peoples. Of course, Germany is a major cultural area and a nation, but in Central Europe and adjacent to it are the quite varied and many Slavic-speaking peoples, starting with Polish and Ukrainian and Dutch and down south into the Balkans and what. And here's a quote from the article. Exonyms often describe others as foreign-speaking, non-speaking, or nonsense-speaking. The classic example is the Slavic term for the Germans, Nemtsi, possibly deriving from a plural of Nemi, which means mute. A standard etymology has it that the Slavic peoples referred to their German neighbors as mutes because their language was unintelligible. And the term survives to this day in many Slavic languages, and I won't give you the words, but I will, in the same basic term, Nemtsi, or something similar, derived from the term mute because Slavic speakers found the Germans, which is a completely different language family, completely unintelligible. So that kind of term survives in Russian, Bulgarian, Ukrainian, Polish, Czech, Slovak, Slovenian, and Serbo-Croatian, Montenegrin, Hungarian, which strictly speaking isn't a Slavic, but it adapted the term from from Slavic. Romania, same situation, not a Slavic language, but they got the term from it, along with, well, this is interesting, another way these things spread, because it's all those first languages, plus the term was adopted into Hungarian, Romanian, Turkish, and Arabic. So you get that example of one culture creating a term for another culture that's different, and then third-party groups coming along, the Hungarians, Romanians, the Turks, and Arabics, coming on, picking up this term, maybe not even being in any way aware of how the background, or where the background comes from, and then using, you know, adopting that term, you know, in this case as a term to refer to Germans and German speakers. A very sort of interesting thing. Another example from Native American cultures or North American First Nations indigenous cultures of a similar thing is another example of such a development is the exonym Sioux, an abbreviated form of Nadu Sioux, derived most likely from the Proto-Algonquin term Atui, which means foreign-speaking, which then comes, then gets generally adopted by English speakers and others to refer to a whole cultural group. And you get that kind of thing happening again and again and again, and persisting within a power dynamic that represents a difficult relationship between dominant groups and marginalized groups, and you can see how really, in the end, both problematic but inoffensive it would be for many of the people caught in that situation. I'd urge you to go to the article. Just look for the term exonym or endonym. Very interesting article, and maybe we'll get... I find this kind of thing really interesting, so maybe we'll get someone from the Department of Linguistics on the show sometime soon to talk about this. Okay, here's some more music. This is from Owen Pallett, who started his career working under the moniker Final Fantasy, and I believe he may have had to change that due to some pushback from the well-known video game of the same name, or well, the people who publishers of that. Anyway, this is from his most recent album, Island. This is Owen Pallett and The Sound of Engines.
When I was a youth and my arms were all in splinters. But out here in the snowy field, I am the winter. My coat, it flies open, and I let you in. The great white noise will be your undoing. A laugh to the heavens and a ride to the jaw. A chorus of the angels and a fall. Woke up in an ambulance, blue finger that freezing. The sound of the engines. Oh, I am wound unhealing.
Owen Pallett, and that was The Sound of Engines from his most recent album, Island. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Speak Up, and I'm your host, Magnus Tiewald. Next up in probably about 7 or 8 minutes, we will be going into today's episode from Front Burner, and they're going to be talking about the return of Major League Baseball, and with no fans in the stadiums and a shortened season, and what that's going to look like and how they might be able to pull it off. Here in BC, yesterday, Dr. Bonnie Henry, in her daily update, delivered some concerning news about coronavirus and COVID-19 here in BC, with the first update since Friday, 102 new cases in BC over the 3 days from Friday to Monday, and representing a fairly significant spike in the number of cases here in BC. Also reported was that, and this is perhaps more numbers that are more significant, although they haven't been grabbing all the headlines, is that there are now 253 active cases in BC, which is the highest number in BC since May 26th. And that the 16 of those patients are in hospital and 4 are in intensive care. In many ways, these are the more significant numbers that we have to be paying attention to. One of the things about, well, you know, it applies to any sickness, but with coronavirus, is that once people get sick, there's a progress to the disease. And it takes time for it to move along in some patients. Not everyone gets really sick, but in some patients to the point where they are needing hospitalization or, more significantly, needing to be admitted to intensive care. And that delay is in the neighborhood of around a couple weeks. And then, you know, and then possible deaths follow from that. We haven't yet seen an increase in deaths, but that's to be understood. And that's to be understood. So I was just distracted by, which you can probably hear as well, the construction noise. They're doing some crazy drilling right over my head here, and I hope that does not make me hard to understand through the radio. Anyway, I will carry on here. It is a little distracting in the studio here. So we haven't seen an increase in deaths yet. In fact, we haven't seen any deaths in BC for a few days now, quite a while, relatively speaking, which is good. But we shouldn't be blasé about that, because just as with the people getting sick and hospitalized and going into intensive care, if that becomes necessary, death, there's a delay as the disease progresses within an individual patient. And so there's that sort of time delay, and the impact of the new cases that we're seeing now reported over the weekend will be coming down the line, leading all the way to deaths. Now, and this is the reason these are significant numbers is because what we need to watch out for in terms of managing the coronavirus outbreaks and keeping a lid on the number of cases is to manage our ability to deal with manage the ability of our healthcare system to deal with the number of serious cases coming through, to make sure that we have both hospital beds and intensive care spaces and other things like respirators and the rest, that we have the capacity to do that. And that's a big part of what the provincial health officer and the Ministry of Health are seeking to manage with all the various measures we've been taking over the course of the coronavirus since back in March. One of the things we need to, right now they're talking about, or it's generally being talked about, and I've heard rumors that it is being talked about within the offices, but just rumors at this point, I think. But, you know, with these increases in numbers brings the prospect of a return to tighter restrictions with increase, you know, we could see kind of return to the lockdown conditions we saw here in BC. We never really had a lockdown as such. We all called it that, and I'm just going to use that term because it keeps it simple, where many businesses will be closed, we'll be asked to dramatically shrink our contacts. Right now we can have a sort of a bubble and get out and do some socializing. We could easily see return to a situation where we're asked to stay home and not really get out in the world and stay home from work if you can, and all the stuff that we went through in March and April and up to early May. And the reason for that is that inevitably we went through a whole lockdown period in order to bend the curve, get control of the numbers, and get the situation down to a point where cases were small and we knew they'd be manageable. At that point, then, you know, the response is to start opening up the economy so that the economy can work, people can get out, people can get the sort of social interactions we all require as human beings and need to feel healthy in our minds and bodies. But that process inevitably means that there will be, as we get out, we interact more, there will be increased chances of transmission. That's what we're seeing with the situations in Kelowna, where over 60 cases, new cases came over the weekend, largely as a result of parties and perhaps not appropriate socializing given the conditions. But this is inevitable, and once the things open up, the numbers will start increasing. So the reason the numbers of active cases and hospitalizations and stuff is key is because those are the numbers that the health authorities need to be watching to determine when it may be necessary to return, either to return to lockdown conditions or to just start returning to certain restrictions. They may not go back all the way to what we were doing in April, but there may be, and this may be necessary so that we can get keep control of the numbers to make sure that, you know, our health system has the capacity to deal with cases. And this was all predicted we talked about this here on this program back towards the end of March, or maybe it was early April, based on a number of different studies, but the one I particularly referenced was one published by the Imperial College of London on March 16th, and you can find it on their website. After this program, I'll post this program to our website with links to these to some of the things I've been referencing here. But it basically predicted exactly what we're seeing now, where we have an initial lockdown period, which was to get control of the virus, and then we ease things up, and then the numbers start climbing, and then you perhaps need to return to a lockdown. You get the numbers down, ease things up again, and you go through a cycle of this, and there's a lot of other things going on that the authorities are doing besides that process, but that's something we have to be aware of and may need to be looking at as the future. Okay, so we're going to go on to Front Burner. They're talking about Major League Baseball. Here, enjoy.
Hi, I'm Josh Block. Major League Baseball is back this week, but if you're hoping Thursday's opener will make it feel like a normal summer, you might be out of luck. Because this season is only 60 games, there's new rules, no fans in the stands, and absolutely no games in Canada.
We're not taking decisions as fans. We're taking decisions on the basis of evidence and the advice we receive to protect the health and safety of all Canadians. We'll still get to watch baseball. We'll still get to watch the Jays play, and we'll do so with a lot of pride. It'll just be broadcast from a different location.
This weekend, Ottawa decided the Blue Jays can't play in Toronto during the pandemic. The Jays now have less than 2 weeks to find a new home in the U.S. They'll be playing a season COVID could end at any time, and in a league that couldn't agree with its players about how to come back at all.
I know the owners are 100% committed to getting baseball back on the field. Unfortunately, I can't tell you that I'm 100% certain that's going to happen.
Today, I'm talking with Caitlin McGrath. She's a staff writer for The Athletic, and she'll give us her outlook for the future of the Jays and the future of the MLB. This is Front Burner. Let's play ball.
Okay, Blue Jays, let's play ball.
Hello, Caitlin.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. I want to start by asking you that the entire NHL is coming back to Canada next month. It's resuming play in Toronto and Edmonton. And can you help me understand the distinction here? Why is that okay, but the Blue Jays playing in Toronto isn't?
Yeah, so there is a fairly significant difference between the return to play plan with the NHL and with MLB. And that big difference is travel. So when you talk about what the NHL is doing and the NBA as well, they're using hub cities or bubble cities, however you want to put it. And essentially that's collecting all of the players and personnel and teams, putting them in a bubble and not letting them out. Essentially, they're all kind of quarantining together. And this sort of terminology that I've learned throughout this whole process is like a modified quarantine. So that's kind of what they're calling it. The difference is that MLB is traveling. So MLB's return to play plan allows for major league teams to play from their home ballparks. To go on the road and to be a visiting team, you have to travel to that team's home ballpark. So essentially, it's not really that much different than a normal major league season in that there's a lot of travel involved. The one difference, they did modify the division. So teams in the AL East and the NL East just play each other. So there's not a lot of cross-country travel. But essentially, that is the big difference.
We've got a statement from Marco Mendicino, who is the Minister of Immigration, Refugee and Citizenship. And he says, based on the best available public health advice, we have concluded the cross-border travel required for the Major League Baseball regular season play would not adequately protect Canadians' health and safety.
Right. Well, tell me more. So Marco Mendicino, tell me more about his reasoning and Ottawa's reasoning about not allowing the Blue Jays to use Rogers Stadium as their home base.
Yeah, so to kind of give like a full little context or background here, there was a scenario in which the Blue Jays had a backup plan, which was playing at their spring training facility, which is located in Dunedin, Florida. Mm-hmm. Of course, now we know that Florida is not a great place to be in terms of rising COVID-19 numbers.
The state's total case count to more than 350,000. And Florida's death toll is now over 5,000.
We have embers and we do have flames. Florida became more flame-like, but it's going to be under control.
And actually, the Blue Jays were impacted. They had an outbreak at their spring training facility a little bit ahead of when this new summer training camp was going to start. You kind of understand why the Blue Jays were pretty eager to come to Toronto. It just felt like a safer place. So a few weeks ago, all levels of government, but ultimately the federal government and Public Health Canada, said it was okay for the Blue Jays to come and hold their summer training camp here. Why that worked is essentially because that was like a bubble environment. They had rigorous testing before they arrived in Canada. They all had to be tested twice and have two negative tests. Mm-hmm. They traveled in private charter, private buses, went straight to the hotel that is attached to the Rogers Center. So they weren't allowed to leave the boundaries of the hotel and the stadium, but those two things are connected. So essentially, you just kind of imagine the hotel and the Rogers Center is a giant house, and they were quarantining together in that giant house.
Right. And you didn't have other teams coming into that house. It was just the Blue Jays training.
Exactly. So that is why the government and public health officials felt comfortable with the training plan, because there was no other travel. It was just coming in and staying in.
But the minute you start bringing in teams from the road, or you send the Jays on a road trip, that bubble has popped.
But then the other element was, will they be allowed to play games here? So that's when it gets more complicated. So that's when you would have the Blue Jays leaving that bubble to go play in the United States. And then you'd also have teams from the United States, including teams that are based out of Florida, like Miami and Tampa Bay. They would be coming into Canada, and they would be playing at the Rogers Center. Ultimately, what the federal government said was that they are also particularly uncomfortable with the Blue Jays traveling to certain hotspots, and including Florida.
The advice that we got was that there were serious risks that remained, and therefore we concluded that there was not a principal basis on which to issue a national interest exemption.
Okay, so with or without Rogers Center, the Major League Baseball is back on Thursday. The Jays have their first game scheduled for next Wednesday. Are you surprised that this announcement comes so close to the start of the season?
I would say that I'm a little bit surprised maybe the decision took so long, just because the plan always involved travel. So if that was a no-go from the get-go with the government...
Right. Why is it a week before their first home game that the final decision came down?
Exactly. There was, you know, an interest in development just even a few days before Saturday. The provincial government, Doug Ford, and Mayor John Tory came out pretty strongly in favor of the Blue Jays playing here. And in fact, Doug Ford was fairly enthusiastic that he wanted to see the Blue Jays play in Toronto. And he, you know, said that he had seen their Blue Jays protocol and MLB's protocol.
Folks, have you seen the protocol? I think the Major League Baseball was 150 pages. And I don't think the NHL was far behind them. Talk about strict. They're even probably stricter than our chief medical officers. But they have great protocol, great guidelines for the players to follow.
He felt comfortable with the team playing here, and public health officials at the provincial level felt comfortable.
We discussed it with the Chief Medical Officer of Canada and along with the Deputy Prime Minister, and we made sure that we discussed it with Mayor Tory as well.
And that was, again, a cooperative effort between all three of the governments to make sure that that happens. They have an excellent plan in place to protect the players.
That was also a little bit of a kind of surprise that you had the disagreement, I guess, amongst the levels of government.
Right. Well, so here we are a week out that Toronto doesn't have a home yet. What are their options at this point?
I would say Buffalo is the site of the Blue Jays AAA affiliate. It's a very nice facility, but that facility is not even built for Major League Baseball. The stadium lighting isn't up to MLB standard to broadcast night games. And then another element to this is that it's just a ballpark, and it's a smaller clubhouse. It's a smaller facility. That's inconvenient at the best of times, but during a pandemic, it's very problematic because MLB's protocols call for, you know, significant physical distancing. The Blue Jays would have to get really creative in terms of repurposing space. So they might have to use like suites in the concourse. And of course, that's doable because there's no fans, but it would still be a lot of work. And then there's another scenario, which is that they would share another major league ballpark with another club. There's logistical challenges of that as well, just because you're balancing two team schedules.
I want to understand why it's taken so long to get this season up and running. I mean, the season was suspended in March because of COVID. But at that time, there was a lot of hopes that they would be the first sport to come back and they would have this captive audience.
And they forged a deal, and a deal that allows them to now look forward and figure out what a schedule is going to look like once games do resume.
It's great, Jeff, to see a collaborative spirit here. But
what happened?
Realistically, the league, MLB and owners and the Players Association, the union, really just couldn't come to an agreement on a return to play plan. So there was a kind of base agreement established in March. It really boiled down to both sides interpreted that agreement differently. What the league was offering in terms of number of games and pay cuts was not acceptable from the players' point of view. They wanted to play more games and they wanted to be played full prorated salaries for those games, whereas the league was coming back with offer after offer after offer where they were insisting on pay cuts and not enough games that satisfied the players.
Players Association said Saturday it would no longer discuss a restart plan after it rejected a proposal for them to make no more than 37% of their salaries for playing 44% of a season.
Well, and it just seemed to drag on and on. I mean, in June, it took Commissioner Rob Manfred mere days to go from saying he was 100% confident there would be a season and then suddenly flip-flopping and said he wasn't confident that there was going to be a season.
Yeah, and that probably was one of the lower points of the whole negotiation process.
It's just a disaster for our game. Absolutely no question about it. It shouldn't be happening. And it's important that we find a way to get past it and get the game back on the field for the benefit of our fans.
Rob Manfred and Tony Clark, the union head, they came away from that meeting not even agreeing about what happened at that meeting. So The league thought that they had kind of come to an agreement, at least an agreement in principle. And Tony Clark came away thinking, no, it's not a done deal yet. I still got to go back to the players and they got to agree. And ultimately, a few days after that, we just saw the league implement the 60-game season.
We may have a breakthrough. Major League Baseball has sent a proposal for a 60-game season at full prorated pay to the Players Association.
There was kind of still bitterness on either side, I think. And, you know, that could have repercussions for years down the road. There's a new CBA needs to be negotiated after the 2021 season. And
their collective agreement.
Exactly. And I would be surprised if it was any smoother than this had been. I would say that this was a bit of a preview as to what those negotiations would look like.
So given the MLB's new plan that we're going to have the 60-game season, I'm curious to know more about how this season is actually going to operate. Like, how will it look and feel different than past baseball seasons?
The main most noticeable change will be there's no fans in the stands. You might see some players wearing masks while they play. You'll see coaches and personnel wearing masks. They're encouraging players to not spit. And honestly, there's so much spitting in baseball that that's going to be a huge challenge for players. And so I think I've been at the Rogers Center throughout the summer training camp. And one thing that's strange to me is that when you're sitting there and a player hits a ball out of the ballpark, you just hear the ball clanking on these empty seats. And that's not a sound that you typically hear when fans are there because people are catching the ball or, you know, there's a lot of noise. The ball doesn't just bounce on seats. And then you just also hear ballpark sounds that are so loud too, like the crack of the bat and the ball hitting leather, like in the mitt. And you honestly hear player conversations, like sitting up a few levels up, we can hear the players kind of talking to each other or kind of encouraging one another on the field, and we're not anywhere close to them. So that's also been strange. And, you know, I'm sure that TV mics will pick up some sound that they're not used to picking up.
I've also been seeing in some of the preseason games that there is this the canned crowd noise that is piped into the stadiums.
Here in New York, the Mets using fan cutouts to fill seats behind home plate while pumping generic fan noise through the stadium speakers.
And it also is quite bizarre to see someone hit a home run, to hear the roar of a crowd, and then the ball lands in this, you know, in the empty stadium.
Yeah, the crowd noise is interesting. I don't know how much of an impact it really has on players. Some of us kind of ask them, and some players actually just say they're so honed in and focused in that moment that they don't even notice. It's kind of like they've got adrenaline going on and they're not really even aware of other sounds. They're just kind of focusing on the game sounds.
This is what it's going to be. This is what it's going to be. This is 2020 baseball. So you got to keep a smile on your face and just embrace it and have fun.
It's like, I mean, you're looking at a pizza, but you know, you're smelling a hamburger. It's like you hear noise, but you know, nobody's in the stands. You don't see anybody. So I think it was dumb.
So the Canadian government's decision is obviously a reminder that coronavirus is still there. It's still a threat to the season.
COVID-19 cases have significantly diminished over the past several weeks. I think that is largely attributable to the sacrifices that Canadians themselves have made. And so the last thing we want to do is see a setback.
Tell me more about the kinds of measures that are being put in place to stop the spread within the league.
Yeah, so the league has a pretty thorough kind of health and safety protocol. Every player gets tested every other day, as well as staff and personnel that are interacting with the players. If they were positive, then they would go into a quarantine. And in order to be back playing, they would have to have two consecutive negative tests. And then they would have to pass sort of other health checks as well and have no symptoms and all that. There's other things like social distancing. Clubhouses are being expanded. They're trying to not have guys even give high fives or handshakes. So you'll see a lot of like elbow bumps and stuff like that. You have this expectation that players will be responsible when they're away from the ballpark. It might change from team to team, just depending on where they're located. But the overarching kind of sentiment that I've heard from players is that they all have to be accountable to one another.
But as players, I think we're all just trying to rally together and just keep ourselves in shape just to be ready for the regular season. We just have to get used to a new environment, and wherever we end up being, we have to get used to that place.
Well, there's already been 80 players who have come back positive for COVID since they started testing in June. I mean, is this a sign that these measures might not be enough, or that certainly it's a real risk to push ahead with this season?
It will be really interesting to see what those numbers are like the first week or two once you have travel happening, because we don't know what it will take for maybe the season to have to be shut down, whether it's a team having an outbreak, whether it's multiple teams having an outbreak. At some point, if there's too many teams having outbreaks, this would be a worst case scenario, but you would have to stop the season, because then you get into conversations not just about health and safety, which would be paramount, but then you also get into like, what's the competitive integrity of the season if you have teams that aren't even able to compete?
Even before COVID, the MLB was in a tough spot. I mean, the league had a million more empty seats last season. There was the Houston Astros cheating scandal, which brought a lot of negative attention to the league.
The owner of the Houston Astros fired the team's general manager and manager after an investigation found that the Astros cheated by stealing signs during their World Series championship season.
And now the league and the players have obviously really struggled to come together and return to a season this year. What does this all say to you about the future of baseball?
I think the baseball has been struggling for a number of years in terms of engaging a young audience. And baseball just really hasn't done itself any favors lately, especially after this kind of tough to watch negotiation period where you had two sides that were fighting amidst a pandemic, which was ravaging parts of the United States. And it was under a backdrop of also civil unrest in the United States. And I just think a lot of people looked at baseball and thought, you know, they haven't really impressed me with the way that they've gone about. And, you know, I'm out. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if some people who, you know, weren't huge fans just decide maybe baseball's not for me. There's still a lot of passionate people that love baseball, don't get me wrong. And I think there's a lot of just interest on what baseball will look like, what will it be like watching games where there's no fans there. So you'll have a lot of people watching, I'm sure. But I just think like this sort of the reputation of baseball has definitely taken a hit.
So what happens when the league has to sit down and negotiate that collective agreement again?
You know what? I don't know what's going to happen. It could result in some work stoppage. It could result in a strike. Like, it's definitely possible that more than a year's time from now, we're again talking about how these two sides can't come to an agreement and how these two sides can't seem to work together. And optically, it could be another mess for MLB.
Well, I want to come back to the Blue Jays before I let you go, and to this season. It's a 60-game season, as we've mentioned, which is very short, and I think that means that any team could get hot for a few weeks and make it into the postseason. What do you think the Jays' chances are at another World Series run?
Heading into this season, the Blue Jays weren't exactly a contender. They're still typically referred to as a rebuilding team. They signed some veteran starters this offseason, but the core of their team are young players, so they're still developing, but they're a really competitive group, and they really believe that this 60 game season could work to their advantage. They think that their objective chances have increased. You do have a tough schedule for them over the 60 games, but you know, I think they're a team to watch. I think they could surprise some people.
Well, I know many people will be watching no matter where their home ends up being. Caitlin, thank you so much for your insights into this.
Thank you for having me.
Before I let you go today, some news on the ongoing protests in the U.S. There have been more than 50 days of unrest in Portland, Oregon, following the death of George Floyd. And last week, to the ire of local officials and protesters, President Donald Trump sent in federal law enforcement. Since then, there have been many reports of police violence.
Multiple videos posted online show officers without clear identification badges using force and transporting those arrested in unmarked vehicles.
Trump responded to widespread criticism, saying he would continue the crackdown and threatened to send in more troops to protests in other states.
More federal law enforcement, that I can tell you. In Portland, they've done a fantastic job. They've been there 3 days. And they really have done a fantastic job in a very short period of time. No problem.
That's all for today. I'm Josh Block. Thanks for listening to Front Burner.
And thank you for listening to Speak Up Today. This program comes to you every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. I've enjoyed having you with me. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up in a few minutes. My name is Magnus. This is CJSF 90.1 FM.